Welcome to Rethink, a podcast focused on the future of skilled nursing. I'm Amy Stulick, senior reporter with Skilled Nursing News. I'm joined for this episode by Bill Weisbert, CEO of Ohio-based Saber Healthcare Group. Saber recently announced a joint venture with the real estate investment trust Omega. The decision was one more of strategic alignment, Weisbert said, rather than out of necessity. The partnership is positioned to be a sector powerhouse capable of disciplined, long-term growth without sacrificing quality or financial stability. Along with the joint venture, Weisbert discussed ties between reimbursement, quality, and value-based systems, Saber's partnership with Optum, and how the sector can evolve to secure public trust. We recorded this interview last month, shortly before two explosions and a subsequent fire led to three deaths and injured 20 people at a Saber-affiliated nursing home. While we were not able to speak with Bill about the fire for this podcast, you can find our coverage of that event, including comments from a Saber leader, on Skilled Nursing News. Our thoughts are with those affected. Before we get to that conversation, I'd like to highlight our Rethink conference taking place September 28th to the 30th in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I know that might sound like a long way off, but this is a great time to get involved as a sponsor or speaker. Rethink is our annual conference that brings together executives for networking and thought leadership with a focus on the trends, challenges, and opportunities in the skilled nursing sector. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to find out more. And now, my conversation with Bill Weisbert. All right, Bill. So to start us off, why don't you tell me a bit about your newly formed business relationship with Omega?
Well, I think the best way to start that explanation is to understand Omega is a landlord. Their primary business purpose is to own and buy real estate as a REIT and find a permanent tenant for that to operate it long term. They've always wanted to buy Saber's real estate. The truth is we're the holders of some of our best assets. To date, we own more of our own assets than anybody else, including Omega. And we have, again, Saber is an operating tenant with a very strong long-term attractive portfolio and a long-term attractive operator made sense. But in our sector, many times, the only reasons you would consider either an all-out sale of your real estate is a total exit or a need for capital. And neither was our case. As my business partner and I consider myself fairly young and enjoy what we do, but more importantly, we did not have a capital need. So a sale leaseback was never really a discussion for us. Selling the assets to Omega as a whole wasn't really an option to us. And in the truth of it, we wanted to acquire more real estate on our own and have our operations teams continue to grow because they have a great deal of capacity. And again, we're in a very strong financial position, so we have the ability to buy our own real estate. But over the years, we grew a friendship with the Omega guys. We had tons of conversations with them. We always wanted to do more together, and that conversation just started to veer towards a JV rather than a sale. And the JV thought was to form a win-win relationship with them. So we discussed ownership and came to a 49% ownership for them and a 51% ownership for us in the JV. And that was going to be operated by a strong operating team with one of the largest capital partners. So in our mind, it was a great relationship to start, and they're a trusted capital partner both in our sector and with us. So we didn't, nor do we want to exit. We had no desire to sell our real estate, and we just didn't want to be a pure triple net lease operating company. So this really was the precipice behind doing the JV. The really exciting part of the deal, though, I think, is when we both wanted more alignment with each other, not just on the real estate side. So in order to do that, we decided that we would offer them a small ownership percentage, in this case, 9.9% ownership in the operating company, which that part of the deal will happen in January. In essence, this creates really full alignment on both sides of the partnership, as we both have a vested interest in acquiring the best communities, both to own the real estate in the JV, but more importantly, to operate these communities at an exceptional and well-capitalized level in the co-owned quality operating company. Neither side just thinks anymore about themselves in this equation, but rather as partners to ensure all sides are in tandem and operating in a directionally correct fashion. Another extremely exciting part of this deal is that we did it without adding any debt to Saber. Our real estate portfolio, even after the deal, still sits at sub 50% loan-to-value leverage. And that allows us for a ton of equity to continue to acquire and grow without either side having to come up with capital. Although both sides are willing and able to, with so much equity now and not bringing on debt into the JV, it just made it, you know, extremely attractive. The operating company has a ton of capacity as well. Both sides have a strong balance sheet. We both have a strong capital. And for us, again, we thought, you know, bringing them both into the real estate and the operating company was a win-win. It was really an outstanding relationship for us, you know, to do this. And it created what we think is one of the biggest powerhouses in our sector with one of the best operating companies, one of the best capital partners, and again, financial strength to really go do whatever we want to do in the future.
Mm-hmm. So Omega's CEO, Taylor Pickett, he called Sabre the private ensign, hinting at growth for Sabre in the next 5 years. And he also said that this growth would be significant and creative. Anything to add here and thoughts on the private ensign moniker?
Yeah, I think in our sector, there's been a great deal of noise and frankly, a lot of failure with some of the larger operators that has led to some bankruptcies and other financial issues that have caused REITs to historically either have to, you know, forego rent or in really bad cases, infuse capital. So when the investor community hears about something like that or a REIT doing a financial deal with an operator, there's that initial inclination to panic and think what's wrong with the operator, and in this case, Sabre, and why did they need cash from Omega? What was the reason for the infusion? And frankly, even though we owned a larger part of our real estate than Omega, we were still a larger relationship with them. And you know, when you look at their board in the investor community, you know, they viewed Sabre traditionally as a triple net tenant, not, you know, really looking at under the hood of what we are. So they can't just sit back and say, well, you know, look, who's the Sabre and why'd you give them money? And really, since Sabre is not a public company and we don't have to share any of our financial results, no one really knows whether we were financially strong, whether we're stable, how we perform within financial metrics. So the question of why would a REIT do this deal, frankly, are only natural. So the best way Taylor, I think, could have answered that question is by creating a comparative narrative that outsiders could understand, as we weren't really known to anybody. So him saying, well, Sabre's great, and that's why we did this investment, really, I don't think is enough. So Ensign really, if we all look at it and agree, they've set the gold standard, as they are both a quality operation-centric organization, but also they perform financially strong, and everybody can see that because they have to post their results. So you have a quality operator with a strong financial position. And what I like to say is really they're doing it the right way. And frankly, the market and investors agree. You know, I kind of look at it like the Ritz, Carlton. When you say you are staying at a Ritz or a Ritz property, you know two things. It's going to be really, really nice, and it's going to have the best service. Well, I think Ensign does that in our sector. You also know that the Ritz is a very valued company that performs extremely well financially while having great properties and exceptional services. Again, you know this about Ensign. They publish it all the time, and they have to report their results. So the truth is that everyone from both our sector and the investor world know exactly what Ensign is, and they don't know what a Sabre is, so it's a good comparison. By comparing us in this way, Taylor was able to say, look, Sabre didn't need a rescue plan or capital or even a partner. We wanted to be their partner, and this is his words, not mine, on the release. They wanted to be our partner because they remind us of Ensign with both their operations and financial results, but no one could know that from the outside world. So the comparison really created comfort and put us out there as a quality-driven and strong-performing company. I got to be honest, I was very proud when I heard him say that. I have a lot of friends over at Ensign. I think they've done a great job. I think that being compared to them, you know, is something that I think we're proud of. I also think that, you know, when Taylor looks at the growth side of it, our model looks like Ensign. We're a decentralized central support organization. We keep all the AR and AP handled at a central location so that our facilities can really focus on what they're comfortable doing, not uncomfortable doing. Administrators, DONs, they don't want to run a business. They want to provide direct care. And I think that's what Ensign and a Sabre does, is take all that heavy lifting of the business side of it and let them kind of stay focused on that local, direct, important part of the business. So in our case, we have a replicatable model. It allows us to grow. And we've grown. I don't think people realize, you know, Sabre's been around for 25 years and Ensign's got longevity. Well, Sabre's been around for 25 years as well. And we started with just one building and have over 140 today. So if you look at it, we've grown a culture. We've grown a team with long tenure, just like they have. We have a proven track record to add communities, just like they've done. We take the business side off of their plate so that they can focus on the bedside. And it's proven a successful model for both Ensign and now if you look at the comparison Sabre. So it gives the market comfort to know, well, there's two companies out there or three or four that can, you know, do it the right way, continue to grow, and continue to have that platform ready to go. He also looked at it as, you know, just like Ensign, you know, they report that they have a strong balance sheet, they have cash on hand, they're ready to grow their portfolio. And just like them, we have the same thing. We have no line debt. We have a strong operating platform. We don't need to, you know, build up or retool or get ourselves ready for any growth. We're ready to go. And so I think what he was saying again is you've got a strong company. You can't see into them. We know that they're a strong company because we can see into them. And there's no deal that just like they can do. There's no deal with an Omega as a capital partner, a Sabre as an operating arm that really we can't do together. So if it makes sense, we're going to go and grow. And I think that that's what Taylor's projecting out there, that both Omega and Sabre are ready to go.
Mm-hmm. And then I believe Sabre has been Omega's operating partner for over a decade. How has that relationship developed and deepened over the years? And how has it changed to meet an ever-evolving sector?
The Omega relationship actually happened by accident. They bought Aviv REIT over a decade ago. And honestly, we were considering not doing business anymore with Aviv REIT because it had changed, especially towards their exit. They were no longer, to us, directionally correct. They just wanted to buy whatever real estate they could and really didn't care about the operating company. So when Omega came on, it was really kind of a welcome change for us. It allowed us the opportunity to reboot our relationship. And in the beginning, they did a great job of educating us on how they worked. They spent time telling us what they wanted to do. But more importantly, they wanted to understand what we wanted to do. They wanted to understand our capacity. They wanted to see, you know, what we were about and how we acted. And it really evolved with them as we spent more time together to build a relationship. And it took a long time, but really what the relationship was working towards was trust. Trust that we had the capacity, trust that as a REIT that they could get it done. And as a REIT, I mean, let's be honest, REITs don't want to operate nursing homes. They just want to own the real estate and keep going on. They want a long-term tenant. And for us is we wanted to be a long-term tenant so with the opportunity to grow. So that level of comfort of knowing that you had a strong capital partner that would help you grow, but they didn't want to interfere with your operations, created just a level of trust over time with them. And that made us want to just do more with them. And as we did more with them, there was more success, which created more time, you know, spending with them and more opportunities and more ability to do things. So they just became a really good partner for us. And as the years go on, you know, you look at landlords and you know, some of them are more focused on buying real estate and owning real estate and treating it like a real estate investment without really caring about the operator. And frankly, it's why I get upset when I hear Omega or REITs compared to PE, because it's not. When you're a PE firm or when you're a landlord that's just buying real estate, you're valuing the real estate. And I think a lot of these new buyers are doing that. And they're just looking at the operator as expendable and replaceable. That's not Omega. I don't think that's REITs in general. The new buyers, in my opinion, only don't value the human aspect of what we do, whereas Omega did, and they understood that we were a people business. And in our business, you know it better than anybody, we're taking care of the most vulnerable. And there's good days, there's bad days, there's good weeks, there's good years, there's bad years. I mean, you want a partner who understands that. And that's what's happened. So I think we've grown really close to them because, you know, there's that fact that that trust factor that we know that they have our back. They know that we have their back. And it allowed, you know, the opportunity over the years to not just build that trust, but to build a relationship, a friendship, where I could pick up the call and the phone and call those guys and have a conversation. And it's not, you know, what have you done for me? Or, you know, they're not counting our money. We're not counting their money. They're not trying to, you know, figure out what we're doing or what we want to do. They're just trying to work with us in the best way forward. And I think that's why we really wanted to do that with our deal with them. And I think it's why our relationship has really evolved over the past decade.
Mm-hmm. So then how do you expect Sabre's relationship with Omega or with REITs overall to continue changing? Especially as we see acuity rise, care costs rise, and financing deals shift?
Honestly, we don't worry about changes like acuity, care costs, or the changing environment for acquisitions, especially now that we're so tightly bound with them. The truth is that being a quality provider with strong finances, you can adapt to changes. You can weather the storms. We have been around long enough with a big enough platform to deal with changes. Acuity is something that we've been running towards already, and we welcome both more acuity and frankly, reimbursement systems that reward this higher acuity. We value, we are running towards value-based results. I'm proud that in my last look at our data, we compare ourselves to our competitors all the time. We have the highest acuity, the highest staffing level to respond to that acuity, the lowest length of stay dealing with that acuity, and the lowest return to hospital with that low length of stay. I mean, that's the winning value-based proposition. And we're already waiting for the market, frankly, to reward us for that and stop paying everybody the same rates. In other words, we want to see the market change, and we're looking forward to acuity, as I think Omega is as well. Costs are something we are also ahead of. In our markets, the Sabre affiliated communities have always been amongst the highest wage payers in market. So when other people are looking at wages and need to move, they might need to move a couple dollars, whereas a Sabre community, you know, might have to move a few cents. So as the market dollars, as inflation, as all those things go up, it's a smaller adjustment for us, and we just don't have to worry about that. And so when you get down to, you know, the next set of costs, you're looking at supplies like food, drugs, medical supplies. And again, Sabre's a force to be reckoned with. And even as prices go up and things change in the marketplace, we have economy of scale. But I think most importantly, and I think this is why Omega really, you know, looks at us so fondly and compares us to an Ensign as well, we pay our bills. We pay our bills timely. Our vendors know that we do, and they reward us with best in market pricing. So you got economy of scale and pricing models based on being a good payer and a good partner that allows us really to keep more dollars at the bedside. So I think that we're just in a great position no matter what the market throws at us. As for deals, and again, this is my opinion. You know, I read a story yesterday that said, you know, the market, there's going to be so many deals. I think the deals that are coming, and I think what Omega and Sabre are prepared for in our JV is that we see a lot of real estate buyers that are paying crazy prices. And they're viewing the real estate, you know, differently than the operator. And I think as they charge exorbitant rent and overpay for these buildings, operators are going to have trouble, you know, fulfilling, you know, to your point, the higher acuity, the higher costs, the change in market. And I think that those operators are going to, I think a lot of operators are going to fail. And I think we're already starting to see that. So, you know, when you hear some of these transactions go and they say, you know, we're going to increase revenue and create efficiency in staff, what they're really saying is they're going to maximize Medicare mix and length of stay, and that they're going to cut staff. And we just don't need to do that. We're you know, we stick with quality. Omega knows that we stick with quality. They like quality operators. They want to be in a place where, you know, we're not the winner's curse of overpaying for buildings. We're buying buildings that make sense, that we both believe Sabre can operate and do well in, and that Omega can feel comfortable at night that they're not going to get the keys handed back to them. So I think we're really set up, and I think we're really excited. I hate to use the word pumped, but we're pumped for the market to change, and we're really happy to have a partner like Omega in the JV and Sabre as our operating arm to move forward in that environment.
Mm-hmm. And then is there anything else that's new and exciting in the works at Sabre? This could be new services, facility acquisitions, staffing initiatives.
Yeah, so we, you know, there's always stuff happening around here. Like I said earlier, we just added 4 buildings in PA from another operator, which puts our footprint, you know, very comfortably as one of the largest providers in Pennsylvania. We just broke ground on a new SNF in Virginia, up in Smith Mountain Lake, a beautiful area, and we're really proud to be able to build a new building there. We just got approval to build on land that we acquired for a new COPN in Virginia. And we're constantly looking at deals. I mean, I always tell people, I sit in every new orientation with our leaders. And, you know, they always ask me what Sabre's plan for the future. And I always tell them the same thing. We're not going to just grow to grow, but we're going to take advantage of opportunities. And we probably look at 120 deals a year. And we do far fewer than those. And like a, you know, comparing again to an ensign, they don't run at every deal. They don't close every deal that they're looking at. We're in the same world. So, you know, we're looking at stuff now. We're always looking at stuff. I foresee that over the next 12 months, we'll have some growth. Some of it's significant. And then we'll continue to just make sure that, you know, as we add things or look at things, that we'll keep doing that. As far as what we do, you know, from a development of our organization, we've done a lot of that over the past, you know, 12 to 18 months. You know, while the market was yielding prices that we felt were a little bit too high or unrealistic and unreasonable for SNFs that we're trading, we took our time internally and invested more into the infrastructure of the organization, our compliance programs, our, like I said earlier, our IT infrastructure. We've added a chief nursing operator to our organization where we didn't have that position before. So we've just continued to strengthen and get ready for, you know, what's coming our way, which, you know, I do anticipate growth.
Hmm. Okay. And Bill, some topical questions for you next. We recently saw that the staffing mandate was repealed. But it seems like certain provisions are still in place. You know, there's the facility assessments and just thoughts on this update and if it will affect staffing initiatives for you guys next year.
No, so Sabre is always ready for whatever is thrown our way because we think that we run at things the right way every day. You know, we put our quality of care first, which, you know, requires staffing. So when you know, I'm always pulling data, looking at us compared to other folks out there. When you look at our staffing compared to our acuity, we're always amongst the highest staffing. So the assessments don't scare us at all because it's what we're already doing internally ourselves. We always want to be prepared. So we're looking at what our patient population looks like. We're looking at what the referral activity, you know, is bringing forth. We're looking at our buildings. When our budgets are being done at the facility level, you know, they're taking their acuity and trying to build a staffing model around that. They're not trying to just build a staffing model around costs. So, you know, whatever assessments, you know, and the assessments don't bother us, but whatever information is required in the assessments, it's pretty standard practice. And it's things that we would want to know ourselves and be prepared for at the facilities anyhow. So there's nothing that's going to affect us. There's no staffing that we need to add. We're already staffed appropriately for our building's acuity and the populations that they serve. So for us, it's nothing that really changed things. I think it will change some stuff for other folks out there. I've seen in the data a lot of folks that are, you know, rising up their acuity and not necessarily addressing their staffing. You know, I see where, you know, some facilities in states that we operate in have acuity higher than ours and staffing that's, you know, much, much lower than ours. I think it's going to affect a lot of providers out there who have been, you know, cost managers or revenue driven, whereas we're just quality driven from day one and from the get-go. So for us, there's not a lot we'll have to do, but I think for the industry as a whole, since it's a topical question, I think it's going to affect some of the providers that, you know, we're just growing instead of, you know, operating their platforms or you know, making things better within their own platforms. I think it's going to affect them more than it'll affect, you know, some of the companies that, you know, we've mentioned before, like the Trilogies, the Pruitts, the Ensigns, the Sabres. I think all of us are ready for it.
And then what do you expect are some major reimbursement challenges in the new year? And also, what's your advice for overcoming those challenges?
Well, I'd like to feel that I'm involved in some of those changes because I've become very political and active, especially at state levels and federal levels, of trying to, you know, look at what systems should be. And I think what you're going to see from reimbursement is, you know, the old days of maximizing your CMI, your case mix, and you know, managing your staffing, I think we're going to see those go away. And I think we're going to see many more states, and even at the federal level, I think we're going to see a lot more value-based. You know, people are talking about it now, but, you know, in all the years that Saber's been preparing for it, it really hasn't taken a hold in too many states. It really hasn't, you know, the MA plans and insurance companies, are they say it, but they're really not rewarding you. And I know we'll probably talk about that later. I think over the next few years, what we're going to see is that real hard push towards quality systems. And, you know, I hate to use the dirty word of redistribution, but I think you're going to see where states don't have as much money to put into their budgets, especially with the provider tax. I think what you're going to see is they're going to want to take the money that they already have, not add to it. And I think that it's going to come to a point where the good guys in the industry, the good providers, the quality first, are going to say, well, you know, maybe it's time to build those value-based systems. So I would say to anybody who is, you know, preparing for what changes would come, I don't know if I'd say it is value-based because that's such a large term to use. I would say, look at quality systems, quality outcomes. What are you doing? What are you doing to deliver quality? You know, it's not just about getting your QMs because they look good on a piece of paper. Are you really, you know, investing in strategies to manage your QMs effectively? Are you really putting systems in place to make sure that whatever the quality metrics are that you're going to be potentially rewarded on in the future are things that you're measuring today? You don't want to learn a system on the fly, like building a plane on the fly. You know this is coming. We all know this is coming. So start getting ready for that now. You know, pick what metrics you're going to use, you know, pick 7-8 quality metrics that are out there and start every month managing, you know, helping your buildings manage to that quality metrics and getting ready for, you know, quality payment systems versus just everybody gets lifted up or reimbursement systems that are trying to reward everybody. I think you'll see more of that. So that my advice would be focus on quality, get your systems in place, start measuring that and know that when, you know, state systems start to change, like we have one in Ohio. Our last rebase in Ohio, 60% of our rebase went into our existing quality system. So if you're going to look at what the future holds, it's where, you know, legislative bodies and governors are going to look to put most of the funds in those systems and you know, drive that because it provides a good basis for them to go out and say, you know, not all nursing homes are bad. Nursing homes can be a good place. They're part of the continuum, and we just put money into quality. So, you know, we're protecting the elderly and the population, and you know, quality systems, I think, are really the biggest point of where I'm going to see or say value-based is going to go. So that would be my advice, is if you're going to maximize anything, maximize quality.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about Saber's involvement in institutional special needs plans or ISNPs. How do you expect Saber's involvement to change or evolve in the new year?
So there's so many models out there between ACOs, REACH, TEAM. There's just so many things out there. And you know, you can chase them in so many different ways. And I think what we decided at Saber was ISNP is pretty simple. You're being rewarded to do what you do every day. So, you know, you don't have to go find new doctors or get them to agree to nurse practitioners or get, you know, ACO models or any of those things. With ISNP, you know, your goal is to treat a resident in place, avoid a hospitalization, and take care of them as best that they need. Obviously, get them to the hospital if they need it, but do everything you can at the bedside and make sure you have the competencies at the building, and you'll be rewarded for that. And so for us, it just made sense to really look at what, rather than trying to do a little bit of everything. I mean, I think if you can't hear it, we don't want to be a company that tries to do everything right. We want to be a company that picks what we can do right and do it really, really well. And ISNP to us was one of those things that, you know, you're protecting against someone getting too sick, and you're protecting against, you know, not identifying when they're about to have an acute episode, and you're building your teams up and your competencies up to try to treat that person in place and keep them at home. You know, that the facility is their home at that point. So, you know, we like the feel of ISNP because we can manage it, we can build a team around it. So if you look at us, we decided, you know, being our footprint is so large in so many communities, we didn't really want to go out and own our I-SNPs. And I get a lot of my peers say, well, why don't you want to own your I-SNP? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? We don't believe in necessarily owning ancillary companies where it doesn't make sense for our care first and our operating model. So we partnered with Optum because we wanted, you know, we wanted a company that we knew could grow with us, that had the contracts, the networks, the everything in all the communities where Saber was. And we just put a lot of energy in, you know, going into those buildings and allowing, you know, Optum's presence to you know, let residents and their families make a choice if they wanted that extra layer. And then to be rewarded for doing basically what we're doing every day anyhow felt right to us and allowed us to put our time and energy and competency training into, you know, one model that we adopted. And if you look at us from our population and where we have penetration, we represent almost 5% of the entire institutional special needs program in the United States. So, you know, we've definitely adopted it and moved towards it. We've looked at the ACO models. You know, it's hard when you start taking in two or three different models in your building or chasing, you know, new models after you've really worked in one for so long. It confuses the families. It confuses the residents. And I just don't put anything in. I don't want anything put in place that's going to confuse people, because yeah, I just had an experience in one of our facilities with my mom. And even being as prepared as I am, even as having done this for over 35 years and, you know, knowing what to expect, it's hard. It's scary. And every day was a challenge. And so I tried to put myself every day as a visitor to the facility and not, you know, one of our senior executives. And I walked in with that set of eyes every day. And it just, there's things that I try to talk to people about undoing or redoing or removing, because it created noise and confusion. And I just don't think in the scary time of whether you're rehabbing or you're making a transitional, you know, move for the remainder of your life, that you just don't need too many options or things thrown at you that can confuse you. So, you know, Saber just made the decision that we were going to pick one model for now and really run at it. It doesn't mean that we're not in ACOs. We, you know, we have a penetration of ACOs in certain markets with certain physician groups. You know, we're in bundled payments in some areas. We are prepared for the team model where we think it will have a presence, but it's not one size fits all. It's not, you know, you have to do what's right for the community. You have to do what's right for the market. You have to do what's right for the residents in that community. So for us, it's, you know, not really trying to do everything, but doing what we do really, really well.
Mm-hmm. And then just thinking about Medicare Advantage overall, anything you want to add about how Saber has fared with MA contracts, with MAOs, and also administrative burdens tied to Part C?
Well, so I think we're all frustrated with MA plans right now. That they don't behave in a manner that I think that they said that they would behave in. You know, as large as our presence is and where we have, you know, market penetration, when you look at our really, we're in six states, but if you look at our portfolio, we're really the largest or up in the top three and four states. And you would think that that would yield an MA plan or an MAO or any of those companies to work a little bit closer with you. And in some cases, you know, they're still being bad actors. They're not offering reasonable compensation. They're not trying to, you know, treat you with respect or remove administrative burdens. And, you know, it's been frustrating. So, you know, do we get better contracted rates than most? Sure. Do we have, you know, the teams in place to negotiate when there's something that should be out of contract or we think is unfair, or residents being treated unfairly by not getting the amount of time or services that they need? Yeah, you know, we can do all that. So that gets the administrative burden. I mean, I've had to add layers of people just to help families and or our billing department with the ADRs, with the denial process, with the certification process, with the recertification process. And so, you know, it's again, another one of those hidden costs of doing business that's been very frustrated. And I think, you know, when we talk about, you know, what the future holds and what policy changes are coming, I think the legislators and the politicians all see it as a problem now. I think the spotlight's on it. So I'm really hoping that some of these MA plans start really looking at it. And, you know, maybe they have reason to do it with some providers out there or in some situations, But when you have a trusted partner of our size and scale, then you know, start looking at the world a little bit differently. So we're faring well, but I'm as frustrated with it as anybody.
And then, speaking of frustration with surveys, how have surveys been in Sabre facilities since changes were implemented in April? Any challenges that cropped up or surprises?
So surveys are, you know, like anybody will tell you, it's so different in every state. And even within the states, it's so different with each district office. We had some states where they started stacking citations, even though they weren't supposed to. And, you know, you go through that frustration and all of a sudden, you know, 3, 4, 5 months later, they're not stacking anymore. But you've lived through the pain of when they were stacking. You have some states that, you know, they're so far behind that I could have a better star rating just if they came in and did my survey, but they haven't done it. So you sit there and, you know, when you get back to those MA contracts, some of them you're precluded from if you don't have the right star rating. And so surveys have been a little frustrating in that I think, you know, the surveyors, let's be frank, they don't have enough bodies either. I think we're all facing the same staffing crunches. They did fall behind, whether that be from COVID or their staffing or both. They keep getting new rules, you know, and again, I think some of the rules are because we've had an influx of change of ownerships in our industry. And, you know, some people don't actually know how to operate yet or are learning how to operate on the fly. And so the surveyors are tasked with trying to manage them, and you get a bad story out and everybody knee jerks and starts reacting to that. So, you know, it's been challenging, but what I found is because of our presence and like I said earlier in our discussion, we've been around for 25 years. We've been in our four core states for a long time. The surveyors know us. I don't think that they turn a blind eye or treat us any different, but I think as things move on, you know, they're looking to try to manage to the lowest common denominator. And as they continue to you know, figure out the changes that are coming at them, I feel like we've fared better than most. So I'm not complaining about surveys other than to say, you know, whenever they do a change, it is frustrating. It's hard to adapt to. But I find that, you know, our clinical teams are usually well prepared. We have so much data at our fingertips that we just are constantly trying to stay ahead of it, and I find that we do. So frustrated, yes. Do I think it's the end of the world, though?
Mm-hmm. So a couple of future-looking questions here for you. I'm curious if there are any policy changes coming up that you are concerned about, anything you're excited to see happen?
So the whole private equity conversation, I'm really excited to get my arms around it because I think PE needs to be defined, and you know, you look at it, and basically you could call anybody that owns their real estate and also owns their operations PE. I think it's an issue that, you know, we need to define what is it that you don't want to see in nursing homes versus what is it that you do want to see in nursing homes. So I'm really anxious to get involved in that conversation and helping to define it. And I think where that will lead us is to CHOP CHOW reform. Change of ownership and change of provider reform to where, you know, now is some people can hide behind the real estate and make a real estate play. And some people can say that they're the operation side. I think that, you know, some of these operators that have signed on to deals to try to grow a business, they don't have the experience. And some of the landlords or, you know, folks that have bought real estate, you know, can just change them out if they fail. And I think having some real, you know, teeth and CHOP and CHOW reform, making a higher barrier to entry is something that I think a policy change that, you know, it hasn't come yet. But I think if we want to be ahead of, I always say, if someone's going to give me a poison pill, I'd rather design it. We're reading all the same headlines, right? The legislatures they're getting frustrated. Some state agencies are getting frustrated. Some, you know, governors are getting frustrated. If we don't start addressing it and helping define it for ourselves, you know, and giving them tools that allow the good to continue to grow and maybe put, you know, some guardrails around people that may need a little bit more time to develop and become good, I think is a good thing. So I expect to see those changes in policy.
Mm-hmm. And then how do you expect the sector to further evolve in the coming years? What factors will influence its evolution?
Well, I'd like to think that I'm going to help shape and influence the evolution. And I think it's going to be, you know, addressing things that you know, are coming at us. It's always frustrating to me that nursing homes get a bad rep. And, you know, even to the point where if someone asks me what I do, sometimes I don't want to say I own nursing homes because I don't want to be judged right out of the gates. I think that we're going to, as a sector, we're going to need to address that and evolve to, you know, promoting ourselves, but doing it in a good way. And also putting rules out there that help make a barrier to entry that you know, shows that we're taking it seriously, that we think, you know, it's a privilege and an honor to care for someone's loved one in their time of need. And I think that we should have a system that, you know, rewards that and recognizes that. And we should have a system that, you know, addresses some of the things that become they're not a lot of stories, but they're bad enough that they create a problem. So I really think that the sector is going to evolve in really looking at shaping who's in the sector. Why are they in the sector? Are they doing the right things? And I think that's where we're going to see a lot of evolution coming in the next few years.
And then what do you think people should rethink about nursing homes? This could be from the public's perspective, operators or government officials.
So I hated the pandemic like everybody did. And I really wish that we weren't saying pandemic anymore, right? But it was the first time in my career where I felt like we were champions, where we were heroes, where we were recognized as being such a critical part of the continuum and you know, finally getting some of the recognition that I felt that we deserved for so many years. Then it passes. Thank God it passes. But then it passes and all of a sudden, you know, we're this, that, or the other. And, you know, hospitals are more important or less important. MA plans are more important or less important. I feel like we need to get the public to rethink that we are a critical component to the continuum. That, you know, if you don't, no one wants to be in a nursing home, right? You never want to hear that you got to go to a nursing home for rehab or for long term. But knowing that you might be there for the good of you, for the good of your family, and rethinking that it could be a positive, you know, especially those folks that end up in a nursing home, their families end up loving us. The caregivers, the aide that took care of my mom is like a family member now. I mean, when you experience it, you realize just how valuable and important we are. And I really think people should rethink, you know, what it is to you know, both serve in one, but actually benefit from one, either as a family member or recipient of the care, and how important we are to the continuum. I mean, if we back up and we can't take admissions, then the hospitals back up and they can't take admissions. You know, we serve such a vital role that I think, you know, I'd love for the public's perspective on that and government officials to really progress and move forward to understand just how critical and important we are to the entire infrastructure of caregiving, to the continuum of caregiving.
All right, Bill. Well, that was the extent of my question. So thank you so much for taking some time and for your insight.
I appreciate the time that you're giving me as well.
That does it for this episode of Rethink. I'd like to remind listeners about our Rethink conference taking place September 28th to the 30th in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to learn more. Until next time, thanks for listening.